Welcome to Candid, where we have real talks with real people. I'm your host, Shanae, and I'm here with Niece, Dudley, and Bethany. Today, we have quite a few topics that we're going to be talking about, and we're going to be starting off with the economy and the finance of the country. Recently, Moody's Corporation, which is a holding company that owns both Moody's Investor Service, which analyze debt insecurities for countries and provide research that help with economic analysis and risk management. So basically, countries go here to get information in order to assess whether they should lend or borrow to other countries. For instance, we get a lot of our money from the US. So the US would go here and they'd be like, okay, well, this is the Bahamas financial standing. Well, I don't think we should give them more money, or I think that we should give them emergency financial assistance. And this is basically what has been happening during during COVID and Hurricane Dorian in 2019. So recently, Moody has downgraded the Bahamas from a BA2 level to a BA3. And according to them, the downgrade of BA3 reflects a significant erosion of the Bahamas' economic strength that was brought on by the coronavirus pandemic, because as we know, the country's main level of income, which is tourism, came to almost an absolute halt, which led to a decrease in the country's national GDP. And they were saying that they expect the gradual recovery of tourism to leave a long-lasting impact on the Bahamas. In fact, they stated that they don't expect our tourist arrivals that we received in 2019, they don't expect them to reach that level again until 2024, which is a few years away, which is very interesting. The severity of the economy's contraction contributed to the significant increase in the debt of the country, which is now nearly over $10 billion, actually, and its interest burdens as well.
Why do you think it's interesting that we won't be back to where we were before in tourism until 2024?
You said, why do I think it's interesting?
Yeah. You said it like you didn't believe it. Are you being pessimistic about it, or?
I think that we're going to get there before then.
I don't think so.
You don't think so? Because.
Nope, not at all. With working in tourism before, we're not going to get there. I don't foresee it happening so soon.
Tourism numbers, I believe, in 2019 were in the millions. We're seeing an uptick in travel. That's 2 years from now. We don't know what's going to happen. I mean, I understand it's a prediction, and I understand the them saying this. I get it. But I mean, I guess I'm just being a little bit optimistic, I guess. Seeing that we have an uptake in vaccinations and a lot more travel now. So that's why I was really saying that.
Even with the uptake in vaccinations, this is me playing devil's advocate as I always am, but even with the uptake in vaccinations, a lot of people are still afraid because this is something that's so unprecedented. And a lot of people fear that even the vaccinations won't help us against COVID. Mm-hmm. And I even saw, like, I'm seeing a lot of things where people are like, when COVID is over, sounding a lot like a lie nowadays, because like it just seems like it's not something that'll ever happen. So it's like people have to feel safe and comfortable, and this pandemic has to come to an end before anyone would feel completely safe and traveling as freely as we used to. Like even now with tourism slightly opened up, I could see why a lot of people, like a lot of tourists, are frustrated because of one, curfew, and two, not being able to have as much freedom as they once had before. So, and that type of freedom won't happen, I don't think, in 2 years. I don't even feel comfortable going outside, and I'm not a tourist. So it's, I don't know. Maybe I'm being a pessimist on the situation, but I don't foresee it happening right now. Bethany?
I think what we need to start doing is finding another avenue for the Bahamas to make some money, because
definitely
cannot keep relying on tourism. It's not something that's stable right now. Who knows what 2024 will bring? This pandemic, nobody knows when it's going to leave. We don't have accurate information telling us if it's getting better, if it's getting worse. Like, there's no factual information with this when it comes to the statistics of it all, especially for the Bahamas. So, yes, predictions say we may have an uptake and we'll see those numbers again. But to wait 2 years for those numbers it would be a grave mistake for our government to just sit on their butts and wait for tourism again. So for right now, they should see tourism as a dead industry and kind of prompt them to find something else to bring in what tourism used to bring in, because that's like a pattern in the Bahamas. First we had sponge, and then we had this, then we had that, then we had tourism. Now it's time for something else.
And sponging was a part of tourism, technically. And I feel like it's kind of like touching the stove. You know it hot. Why you keep touching the stove? Like, I feel like all that effort we keep putting into tourism. And there's nothing wrong with putting effort into tourism, because the Bahamas is a beautiful place and we have a lot to offer. But it's like, at some point, service turns into servitude. And it's like, okay, let's try something else. Like, a lot of people are demanding an orange economy now, and that's something I think we should really look into.
Yeah, I definitely agree with you guys, but another issue with starting a new industry right now is obviously you need government investment, and the country being so deep in debt, it's kind of difficult to say jumpstart a new industry. Now, granted, I feel like this is something that should have been looked at a very long time ago. We should have never put all our eggs in one basket. Yes, tourism is great and it brings in a lot of revenue, but this is not the first time that tourism has stopped or slowed down for a little bit. You know what I'm saying? So I feel like they had instances they should have said, okay, well, maybe we should try something else. But I feel as though they're not pushing the issue. Even if you're not having like a full-blown industry, as simple as something as feeding ourselves, like investing in feeding ourselves, fishing and farming. And I know that they've done a little bit of that with like BAMSI and allowing degrees and those type of things. I know quite a few people who are studying degrees with BAMSI. But it's just like more needs to be done. And like you guys said, with the orange economy, like these are all aspects that should be looked into. And in fact, the orange economy can add to tourism as well, because a lot of people travel for that type of stuff, travel for theater and want to know that, hey, there's something different that I can do here. You know what I'm saying? So yeah, I definitely agree with you guys, but we also have to look at like the fiscal reality of it, like what we're gonna do, because there have been billions of dollars pumped into tourism. I'm not saying that they should constantly pump billions of dollars into it, but I mean it's literally a really expensive thing we have going on here. So I guess I understand why they keep pumping into it and why they want it to work, but at the same time, just like if you take a fraction, an eighth, a 12th of the money that you pump into it and pump into somewhere else, it can be beneficial to Bahamians as well. So
I'm a bit confused by your stance on it. Do you want them to pump it into tourism or the opposite? Because it seemed like you said
I'm
both.
I'm on the fence. It's like
I don't think that's something you could be on the fence about. I feel like either you pump it into tourism or you pump it into something else. Because
no, you can't like, be on the fence.
By sitting around and doing nothing, you're technically pumping it into tourism, because you're not changing it and allocating those funds to something else. You know what I'm saying? So it's like either you put it into tourism or you put it into another industry. And I don't think it would be wasted money, because a lot of people are like, oh, but we already put so much money into tourism. But tourism had to start from somewhere. Like it started from nothing at some point. So you've got to put money in to see returns. So I feel like they should be investing into it. And they are doing it. Like they're doing the housing things where they're putting money into younger people. And there was another thing that they were doing where they were giving business loans to smaller businesses. And I think that's a start. Like they're doing it. It's just they need to put more effort into it than continuously putting money into a failing business. You know what I'm saying?
What I'm trying to say is that yes, we should focus on other stuff. We should pump money. The money, I don't think that you should pump, let's say, I don't know what the numbers are because I haven't looked at like the budget or whatever, but let's say they're pumping $5 million into tourism every year. I feel like you should cut that down and you should allocate funds to somewhere else. But I'm just saying that maybe how they're looking at it is, like if you say playing devil's advocate here, maybe how they are looking at it is, okay, well, we put $4 million towards tourism, but if we want to start a new industry, we'll have to pump $10 million. Granted, they may not have to pump all of that, but we know how our government works. And I'm just saying, like, that's probably how they're looking at it. Okay, that's a lot of money. We don't have the money to pump all that money into a new industry. So we're just going to keep this little bit we have here allocated for tourism. And I honestly think that's how they're looking at it. They're not really thinking of what of the future, you know what I'm saying? Because if a pandemic like this is happening now, who's to say it doesn't happen again in another 10, 15 years? This seems to be something that's becoming more apparent because we had the Ebola outbreak. Of course, that didn't go global, but the fact that these outbreaks are happening more often, like, I feel like you need to focus on something else. But that's probably how they're looking at it.
Tourism in this country is like a life support patient. Tourism has been on life support in this country since independence, if you look back on it. Because tourism isn't an industry that we necessarily started as Bahamians. It's something that we inherited from colonialism. And it's just like, out of everywhere else in the Caribbean region, the Bahamas looked the prettiest and was closest to the United States. So the people from America was like, well, it's just a boat ride. It's like 2 days, a couple of days to there by boat versus going to somewhere else where it's like, that's really, really far. So instead of going really, really far, we're going to go right there to the Bahamas. So everything, it's been years since the Bahamas was born. We've been investing into tourism. The Bahamas spends money on tourism like the world spends money on war. So a little $5 million into tourism is an understatement. We do everything in our power to hold on to this with a fingernail if we have to. They bought the hotel back from Grand Bahama. The F&M bought the hotel back from Grand Bahama. When they got inside, it was empty. They were so sure that that hotel was going to boost Grand Bahama's economy. Like, they gave us their word. And then they gone inside the building, empty. And everybody was like, oh, Lord, what we could do? All the things gone. All the tourists, they ain't gonna come here because they ain't got nowhere to stay. And it's been Bahamas gone independent in 1973. It has been 48 going on 49 years. We have yet to dedicate ourselves into the transition into another industry. How is it we used to be some of the leading agricultural people in the world, and then all of a sudden it's like, yeah, well, we can't necessarily feed everyone. We know we used to be able to send food to everyone and to places around the world as well, but we can't do that no more. So tourism should not be our primary industry. It was never destined to keep all of us, to keep going until, you know, for the end of time. At some point, something gonna happen. COVID just so happens to be one of the many lists of some things that could have happened.
Since Dudley touched a little bit on colonialism, we could transition this conversation to
Michael the Archangel.
Look, it is so interesting how fast and how fast history could change, because now he is embellished in Bahamian history for damaging Christopher Columbus's statue on Government Hill.
First of all, before we continue this discussion on Christopher Columbus's statue, quote unquote, I want you guys to be honest with me. If you've ever seen a picture of Christopher Columbus or a painting of Christopher Columbus, that statue looked like anything like Christopher Columbus. Wait, who is that man?
Paintings of Jesus don't look like Jesus, so.
Paintings of Jesus don't, but we have, listen, you don't have the most of a description you have of Jesus is a man of bronze skin with woolen hair. You have whole paintings, several paintings, dedicated to Christopher Columbus before his voyage, after he landed here, and they don't look, that statue looks so slim, and in them paintings, he's a tick fella, you know.
Yes, Dudley. Well, so back on the issue of him sledging off Christopher Columbus's leg, that one incident sparked so much debate, and it kind of brought it back up because a few months ago, there was a petition that about 30,000 Bahamians signed to have the statue removed, but it was never done. So, in your opinion, was this action, was it necessary? Like, do you side with him? Do you have a different opinion? Because there's so many different opinions out there concerning this one statue.
I am 10,000% of the opinion that that statue should have been removed. Now, am I saying that he went about it the right way? Legally, no. But my question would then become, if he didn't do it that way, what was going to happen? Because you said we put the petition was put out a couple of months ago. I remember signing a petition for this a couple of years ago. And then I remember the discussion of this being relevant also a few years back. And every time we talk about how the Christopher Columbus statue needs to be moved because this man is a monster in history, government always placates people by saying, we'll bring it before the House. We're going to take a look at it. We're going to do X. We're going to do Y. We're going to do Z. But we have yet to move the statue. So it, after years and years and years of people being like, wait, we don't want it here. This man who, unfortunately, from the sounds of things, is a person who actually has a mental illness. This man was just like, it gone. He was really going to break that whole statue down on the front, on the steps of Government House if they didn't get him, because he was dedicated to the cause. Yeah, we could talk about the legality of it. Obviously, that was an illegal action. But what was going to happen? Who was going to do something else? Because the government seemed to be kicking the can down the road for a little bit too long. And people just, in idle conversation, it's just they're like, so, babe, why are we still justifying? Why are we still honoring this, babe? So, I mean, this, I feel like it's past time for that statue to be moved, since I learned in like grade 11 that Christopher Columbus was a monster. And I was in grade 11 a long time ago.
I mean, yeah, I definitely agree with you, Dudley, because I remember in primary school, like, we always like kind of glorify Christopher Columbus as the man who discovered the Bahamas. But like, as I got older and I went through history in senior high, and I was like, but I always questioned, like, why did we honor this man? Why was there a day named after him? Why did he so-called discover the Bahamas? And it just didn't make sense to me. And like you said, when I went to grade 11 and I took history, and I was just like, okay, this dude was out there killing people and raping people and stealing people's children. And it was a lot going on. And like Dudley said, they were never going to do anything about it, as simply as what that was last year or year before last, when they put up the Christmas tree and then Bahamas run off and say this Christmas tree ugly, and then the next day they fix the Christmas tree. It's like, we always have to become uncivilized or radical in order for them to do something about it. So yeah, I mean, I guess he get tired. He was like, you know what, this ain't make no sense. And he started knocking it down. Like Dudley said, I don't know if that was, it wasn't legal, but I mean, it got the job done, because the petitions wasn't working, the discussions wasn't working. And like I said, the only way they seem to listen to us is when we get radical about stuff.
It definitely was not a legal way to do it. And I'm not going to sit here and say I'm upset that it's gone, because in 1492, Columbus lost his shoe. Anyways.
But when you look at it, I know I've spoken to some historians, some Bahamian historians, and a few of them, you know, they're waiting on to see what the government decides, whether or not they're going to use public money to restore the leg or just to remove it. They want to put together and kind of get the statue back to its former glory. And then there's other historians saying, well, they should leave the leg. They should leave the leg off, because now that's a part of our history now, and have it moved to the historical site that the PLP claims that they have near Fort Charlotte, I think. And so I don't know, maybe if the FNM had carried on the PLP's initiatives to actually create the park, the historical park, this probably would have never happened. But then I think the story with Atlantis and Atlantis not paying their staff the amount of money they're supposed to be paying, that's something that we should be focusing on, like the treatment now. I don't look at that statue, I feel no ways for that statue. Like, that statue literally means nothing to me. There's so much things going on that we need to tackle right now that that statue can't, it's so irrelevant. So I don't know, how do you guys feel? Because I just think it would, I think I drive past the statue almost every other day. I don't care anything about it. I care about what's happening to the Bohemians now.
I definitely see your point. And on social media, a lot of people are arguing, saying, oh, well, we're dealing with this, that, and the next. And yeah, okay, we're dealing with that. But obviously, why can't you deal with this too? You say you may not care, but a lot of people care about history. I care about history because if you don't care about it, it's going to get lost. Honestly, it's going to get lost. And then your great-grandchildren, they're not going to be able to tell you maybe who Christopher Columbus was, the real Christopher Columbus, that is. And a lot of stuff gets lost in translation, I feel. So I think it is important. And like you said, we have pertinent issues, but why can't that be something they do on the back end? You can focus on a few issues at once. You don't have to just put all your attention on this particular issue. And something as simple as removing a statue shouldn't be so difficult, if that makes sense. You know what I'm saying? So I definitely see your point, but it's like you can't ignore it, if that makes sense.
The history of that statue is that a lot of the times oligarchies come and pillage nations and then they get glorified for it. And that's why people are so upset about it, especially Black people and people of Indian descent, because he raped and killed. And even it wasn't just the Arawaks or the Lucayans that he had raped and killed. It was even his own people. He would punish them meaninglessly. And when he went back to Spain, he was disgraced. So there's no reason for us to have a statue of him. And also, we always act as though we work for the government, but the government works for us. If we say that we want something removed, they should have it removed, is my simple opinion on that. But I do think it's unfortunate that a lot of the times when there's people who are standing up for our rights, it seems that they have mental illnesses, and it kind of causes people to want to devalue the issue. But it's still a very big issue, and I think that it shouldn't be devalued by the fact that he was mentally ill. You know, I'm fine with the statue being removed, and I don't think it should be fixed. We have, like you saying, there's a lot more issues in the Bahamas, and I don't think money should be allocated to fixing a statue that we wanted removed in the first place.
Let's be real. You could talk about the history of the Black people who paid for something for JMZ Carmichael or whatever, or Mr. Carmichael back in the day. If those families came together and made their money. And this is why the history of this country is so important, because a lot of it is very lost. There is there's claims that these Black families got together. There's a claim that they wanted it of Carmichael because he was an abolitionist. Some say he wasn't an abolitionist, but let's say he was. They were paying, quote unquote, the government to put up a statue in honor of that man. The government turned around and put up a statue of an individual who, no matter how you want to look at the value of the statue and blah, 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 they put up the statue of a person that almost single-handedly committed genocide against the local people of the Caribbean. He killed all the Tainos, but he also wiped out the Caribs. The whole Caribbean had things lost because of him. So why are we going to say, well, we're preserving history? History of this man has been written. It's been whitewashed to thy kingdom come. You have a song about it that you teach in primary schools. You have people who never take history in high school that don't know the truth about Christopher Columbus. And they stick with that song that he kicked the shoe, sailed across the ocean in 1492. You have all of that. But the irrefutable historical fact, out of all the conflict that happens with what happened here locally, the irrefutable fact is he is a fraudulent committer of genocide. Why would we try to defend that statue? It just needs to be removed. There's no other discussion that needs to be had. If historians say it's important for history's sake, then let it stand somewhere else. Every time I've driven past that statue, I've been uncomfortable that the man who killed the natives of this country is overlooking where the tourists come in. That is so disgusting to me. And as you can hear, I'm more than gleeful that it's covered up, at the very least covered up from the public eye.
I agree with Dudley. It's not like we're asking for people to forget history, okay? Because he was a big part of history, positive or negative. He was a big part of our history. We're not forgetting that. You could definitely move that statue to a museum and we wouldn't have had this issue in the first place. It's a lot of the times that we think that it's always like it's always black and white, that you have to do drastic measures to appease people, but you can always just find a gray area. So the gray area would be not to destroy the statue, but to move it to a museum or move it somewhere else, but not in our town center. You know what I'm saying?
I definitely agree. Like I said, if the FNM had moved the statue and put it in the museum, all of this wouldn't have been a big deal, especially since I think Dudley said a few years ago, people were petitioning from that time. So it wouldn't have been a big deal for us to do, especially at that time, because we didn't have Dorian, we didn't have COVID, like the funds probably were there. But I've read that the PLP now, you know, talks are in the making again, you know, talks always in Parliament about this issue every time it arises, but they're trying to get the national park there again. So I pray to God that they actually do it. But then again, here we are in the pandemic and we don't have funds. We literally just talked about how, you know, our number one industry is kind of plummeting. So I don't know about all of that, but I don't think that the government should repair it, because now, like I said, that's a part of our history. So we should keep it just as is. And I hope to God one day that, you know, we start recording things happening now. So when our great grandchildren and stuff, if I ever have some anyways, but when future generations look back, they're not confused like how we were confused about Christopher Columbus. They can go back and find out information, accurate information about what occurred, you know?
Yeah, Bethany was talking about what we're learning and variations and so on, right? But it's my hope that education in the Bahamas becomes more cohesive and we stop learning, needless to say, a bunch of foolishness. Because I remember entering into the University of the Bahamas, I've taken numerous history classes, I think about 5 or 6, right? And every time they would say, lecturers would tell me that we've been appealing to the Ministry of Education to change the curriculum, not only on history, but a few subjects where students aren't being taught adequately. So when you go to high school, you're in high school and you're learning these things, right? Most of the time, you're not learning the correct information. And I pray that that stops, because if you don't choose to go to tertiary education, if you don't choose to learn history in tertiary education, which a lot of people don't, because a lot of people don't think it's important or they have other things that they want to do, which is fine, right? Then you wouldn't know. And a lot of people are walking around and don't know. And that's extremely sad. You know what I'm saying? It's really sad. And I hope that one day the government can change that, hopefully. So segueing back into education, right? Minister of Education Marcellus Taylor has stated that about 30% of students are still not showing up to online classes. And obviously they're in virtual, they're not even hybrid, I believe. No, they're not hybrid, schools are empty. And he said that some of the reasons are that individuals may not have electricity, they may not have internet or devices, which are major problems for those who live in urban areas, or who parents just can't afford it because of the pandemic, maybe they were laid off. And he reached out and he said, you know, if you're having these issues, contact the school and we'll try to help you as best as can, right? As best as we can. But do you think that school should be reopened at this point? Because these students have been disenfranchised for almost 2 years now. Like, a lot of people aren't learning virtually because it's not their cup of tea. Or maybe it's just the delivery is different, you know, and it's not something that they're interested in. And especially since with the opening of Parliament and there were 1,500 people there and the promises of free testing by this administration, do you think that at this point school should be reopened?
I mean, I have a hard time. I feel like I got to be Sinead. I got to sit on the fence with this one this time. because school, all government learning being virtual and private schools requiring to request that they can have the in-person learning system, it is very damaging to people because, I mean, you have, how are you expected to properly teach a first grader to learn their colors, learn their ABCs, learn how to write, how to count, if you're not there seeing them learn how to write, if you aren't ensuring that they're phonic, that they're phonetically connecting what they hear to what they write down, you're just doing a bunch of guesswork. So I feel as though for primary school students, for sure, schools need to be open. And yes, that comes with a great risk. And that great risk is a part of the reason why I feel as though schools shouldn't be reopened, because the Delta variant is the most prevalent variant in the Bahamas now, according to PAHO. So the most infectious and deadly version of the virus is just out there looking at you, doing the Birdman hand meme, just waiting for you to come to school just so you could go home. And you know, when kids, it's been recorded that some kids get horribly sick, but a lot of times kids catch COVID, they have a fever, and then bing, bang, boom, they done. All of a sudden, they ain't got the fever no more. The COVID was gone, but they have COVID, and they go home, they carry the COVID with them. The whole house gets infected, because by the time it was their fever start catching, you already been around the child already been running up and down everywhere. Kids aren't the cleanest individuals, so they done touch up everything. You know, it's just like, you caught between a rock and a hard place to this situation. If you open up the schools, there's a greater chance that there are more people that are unfortunately going to lose their lives. But if you don't open up the schools, you run the risk of the national average that, you know, everybody's made a joke about it, but everybody still takes it seriously. That national average might move from a D to an E, which is the most horrifying thing, is to have a civilization of citizens that can't read or write. They're just uneducated, and it's no fault of their own. It's a fault of the circumstances around them.
Yeah, I definitely agree with you, right? But how I feel about it is, if our government, right, can hold an opening up, and I'm referencing this because I can't believe that there were 1,200 people there, right? I still cannot believe that. Why is it that we cannot, our education system cannot function? Why is that not possible, right? I remember I was speaking to my mom, and she said when she was growing up and she was going to school, they would have a school outside underneath the tree because, you know, obviously if there are 30, 40 people in a classroom and the class is only so big, obviously social distance would be impossible, right? But even if you don't go back to school fully, there needs to be some type of hybrid model, because like you said, in the primary schools, these kids are at a major disadvantage. You know, I have a little brother who's been in the pandemic from K-5, the end of K-5, and he's now in grade 2, and it's rough, especially on parents, because you have to work, right? You have to work, and you have to be worrying about if your child is doing their work. And I just feel like there should be some consideration for this, because like you said, you don't want a civilization that's just uneducated, and that's what's probably going to be the outcome. And then in the next 10-15 years, and most of these kids are coming out of school, and that sucks. It really sucks, and I feel like there needs to be something done about that.
I mean, the opening of Parliament took place in an area that probably has a backup generator for the backup generator, right? So this all goes down to 49 years of independence. We have seen, we know that we all make the joke that BEC, now BPL, and the most, you know, and the most reliable people, you know, in a thunderstorm, sometimes the schools go out, all these different things. It's like you could have, the infrastructure of the country comes into question now, because you have, as you said, you have a big ceremony, 1,200 people in attendance, just seeing everything happen. And then you have, then on the one hand, you have that. Then in the next hand, you have the future of your country the people who will one day become the electorate, the people who one day might decide to throw their hat in the ring in the politics, they just suffering, like, ain't learning.
You know, I can see why Sinead would be so passionate about this subject, because, you know, we all want the best for each other, and to see how young people are being affected, especially when it comes to their education, it's really disheartening. And like Dudley pointed out, you know, with this pandemic, it's so, you know, you don't want to make a decision and then something tragic occurs, like a child dies of COVID, you know, stuff like that. So, you know, sometimes the answer to certain things, it has its gray field, because, you know, to make that decision as a government body and to be held accountable if something were to happen, I wouldn't know, because obviously society is going to blame the government for allowing schools to open up, and then they're going to find some reason to blame the government, and then, you know, the parents, the pain and anguish the parents would be going through during that time, I don't know. But then, Sinead, is there any other schools, like, can we model any schools around the world opening schools and letting, you know, the younger set of children go, those who really need that one-on-one interaction? No, yeah, I was saying, because I know a lot of times people were like, we could model this country, we could model that country. Statistics, you know, are very low. I know at one point, a story where it was out where it said that a school had opened up and allowed the little children to come back, and the contracting of COVID was very low. So do we have any models that we could emulate?
Well, I can't think of any internationally, but there have been some private schools here. Of course, they're significantly smaller than the average government school, but last semester, not this semester, because my brother is back fully virtual because of the mandate by the Ministry of Education, and I believe they just went back to hybrid. But last semester, before the summer, like 2 months into it, they had said, okay, you guys can come back to school. And he was going back to school. He was going to school every single day. And they only had, I think, 2 COVID cases in the entire school, and both cases were isolated, and it didn't turn out in an outbreak, which I thought was very interesting. And I was like, this school has it together, and it can be done, you know. It's just, you have to take the measures to do it. And I understand that government schools are big, right? So maybe what they need to introduce is maybe a hybrid model of some sort, for students to learn, because even if you don't do it with high schools, with the kids, the little kids who in grades 1, 2, and 3, they're at a huge disadvantage, you know? So I think that's definitely something that the Minister of Education and the government and health officials need to sit down and talk about. And they keep talking about this COVID testing that they want to implement, this free COVID testing. So maybe what they have to do is, maybe when they send the kids back to school, they have to set up a testing center there at each school or something like that. Because we honestly can't continue like this. And like you said, you know, you don't want there to be major outbreaks, but you also don't want your children to be disadvantaged and not have the education that they deserve. So I think that, like, there has to be some common ground, and it can be done because private schools are doing it. My sister, she relocated to a different school this semester, and they've been fully in person, face-to-face, and they have not had an outbreak either. So, I mean, it could be done. It's just, you have to figure out how you're going to do it. So that's my thoughts on that.
Yeah, we don't really have to, I mean, like Sinead said, we don't have to look far. We don't have to always look somewhere else to see the solution. Sometimes the solution is right here at our doorstep. Private institutions have somehow managed to make it so that very few outbreaks or little to no outbreaks take place. So it's a big government institution. What makes that harder? You know, somebody putting in their own personal time and investment and care could do it. The government's job is to care about the citizens.
Well, another another proposal that the government has had besides free COVID testing has been the reduction of VAT, reducing it to 10%. And apparently a lot of Bahamians are happy about this. I mean, who wouldn't be happy about a reduction in tax? However, is this the right time to reduce VAT, seeing that we are in so much debt and we're not in the best fiscal place, financial place? So currently VAT is at 12%, and there have been quite a number of tax exemptions that were permitted underneath the F&M administration. The Honorable Dr. Hubert Minnis, he took out some exemptions on breadbasket items, which is like basically bread, rice, and stuff. That's what a lot of Bahamians buy. So when you exempt that, when you take that out of VAT, that takes a lot of money out of the country's pocket, right? And actually financial and economic leaders actually advised the government against this, but they did it anyway, right? So now the question is, if you remove 12% VAT and you add 10% VAT, so you're reducing it by 2%, are you going to leave these tax exemptions, or are you going to be charging us VAT on everything? Because if you decrease the VAT, you're decreasing the amount of revenue that the country is bringing in, which can possibly be detrimental to us. Minister of Economic Affairs, Michael Halkidis, he said that this is what they're looking to, and this bill could be proposed as early as the next parliament sitting. So I feel like we're in a huge financial hole, and I don't necessarily think that lowering VAT at this time would be the best thing to do. This is the beginning of their term, and I understand that they want to deliver on their promises, which is great. But I feel like maybe this is something that they should look forward to, maybe the ending of the term. And there were rumors that this was only supposed to be for a year anyway. So if it's only going to be for a year or 2 years and this is not a permanent thing, I think that maybe they should try this in their fourth year, after they have tried to get the country in a better financial situation, and after they have obviously lowered the debt, because $10 billion is a lot of money, right? And VAT brings in a good chunk of change. So I don't think lowering that right now would be the best decision, but I'm not necessarily against lowering the VAT on the whole.
I mean, lowering VAT sounds really nice, right? It's a dream. Like, you could imagine you going to buy, wait, you know how much things VAT on? You could imagine going to the pump and you ain't got to pay VAT on gas? Lowering VAT sounds like the best thing since the invention of sliced bread and bottled water. There was an economist, Marla Dukarin. She was on the radio and she said that, you know, even though the idea of VAT getting increased sounds so great, right? It's what we want. We want all the prices to go down just a little bit on everything so we can make it to the next state. It's like, all right, so if VAT gets lowered and VAT makes a good amount of money for the government to pay off the debt, what's the backup plan? Because they keep saying there is a backup plan, but we've never heard the details of the backup plan. So what's the backup plan? And in fact, to quote her, she said, the thing about it is that kind of policy in and of itself, all other things remaining the same, will cause a reduction in revenue. However, unless they announce some revenue measure or measures, perhaps that's the trade-off they had calculated. So I have no problem with them making it less expensive for me to do what I got to do on a daily basis. But now that I have some idea that comes at the threat of the Bahamian dollar and the US dollar not being 1-to-1 anymore, it's like, all right then, so cool. What's the backup plan, though? I would love to hear that.
Well, in the report that I watched that was on Eyewitness News, where he was being interviewed, they keep saying, oh, we're going to look into other financial revenues, to gain financial stability for the country. But like you said, they're not indicating what exactly they're trying to do. And I can't get fully on board with the idea of reducing that unless they could show me where they're going to make up for it. You know what I'm saying? Like, I definitely want VAT to be reduced generally, but looking at the state of our country right now, I don't think it's possible at this current juncture. Maybe it could be revisited again, like I said, at the end of their term. But right now, unless they could say, okay, we're going to cut from this, that, and that, and they can say, okay, this is how we're going to make this work, then I don't think that should be something that they're just doing, because it's just going to look like they're just making decisions to make people happy, but then they're putting us in a deeper hole, and that doesn't make sense.
Okay, I have 2 points on the matter. The first being, I believe Marla Buchanan is the same one who was saying that we would be in a IMF program by 2021, and we're not in that. And the IMF program that she's been advocating for so long is not as great as it seems. It's literally selling your country away, and I don't agree with that in any way. But to play devil's advocate, because, I mean, we all wanted VAT to decrease until we realized that our debt was now $10 billion. So that's like unfathomable. I don't think that's something that can happen. But let's say they do that, right? I think something that we could also consider is that by lowering VAT, people have a little bit more change to spend freely. And then they would be putting that money into Bahamian businesses, maybe, and that would kind of increase the flow of money. So people would feel less tight about the money that they're spending because they got this 2% extra. And 2% don't sound like a lot, but it adds up. So maybe that could be something they're thinking about, that people would feel, especially because a lot of people have lost their jobs and a lot of people are feeling the ramifications of Hurricane Dorian and COVID, that they would feel a lot more free with their money.
I mean, all this does is, for those who will have the ability to look back, is retroactively make the Christie administration in their introduction of VAT, it just retroactively makes them seem forward thinking, because we're talking about VAT being a 12% at chance of getting reduced to 10%. VAT was originally going to be introduced to 15%. At 15%. And now we're like, oh, well, we're going to decrease it for a year. We're going to put it, and then depending on how that year works out, we're going to see about, you know, we might have to put it back at 12. We might have to put it higher. So it's like, we got to pick what we're going to do. Like, if VAT works for now, do we bite the bullet and just accept that VAT working? Or is there another kind of tax that has to be introduced to the country to supplement for that 2%? And if it's another tax, people don't like being taxed. So these are the questions we got to look at now.
Yeah, I think Dudley brought a good point to the table. I think if the PLP government were to be honest with Bahamians and actually lay out the plan so they could kind of decide whether or not, okay, because this is a democracy. So as a country, yes, we want to lay back, push taxes down, and then see how we bounce back, you know, in the next year, because it's only for a year, or keep pushing with the 12% and see how the country goes. I think if every government were to be transparent, the people would be more at ease to what they decide for the country. Like, yeah, point blank, if you were to tell me, okay, if we go 10% when 2023, yeah, let's say 2023, the end of 2022, 23, we may have to push it at 15% if the economy bounces back how we plan. As a country, do we want to see a 15% tax at the end of 2022, 2023? If the majority says, no, we don't want that, let's continue what we're doing, then that's what we should do. I think people would be put at ease if we were to have all the plans set in our faces and have it in a way where every Bahamian could understand.
That's the dream, eh?
Yeah, that's definitely a dream.
But back to the 15%, right? I feel like the governments are being unrealistic with themselves, right? Simply because how can you tax 15% when the minimum wage in the country is so low compared to the living wage? And you know what's interesting to me is that a lot of people like to try to devalue the studies that the university has done and that independent researchers have done on how much it actually costs to live in this country. And I believe that it's between $2,000 to $2,600 for a single person in this country. But the average person who comes to the school who just goes, let's say who goes and works at a minimum wage job, they're only going to be making between $800 and $900 a month. How are you then supposed to survive? So is pushing the tax up necessarily the best thing to do? Is pushing it down necessarily the best thing to do? And like Bethany said, I think this is something that should be discussed as an entire unit, as a country, and the government shouldn't just be making snap decisions, because it doesn't really speak on democracy. And the whole point of democracy is the people, power in the people. And if we feel like we cannot afford 15% as average individuals, because some people can afford it, some people cannot. And I would say that the majority of people cannot. So we have to weigh our pros and our cons. And I think 15% is a stretch right now, seeing that we haven't even gotten an increase in minimum wage that was promised. So I think until we could get a little bit higher of a minimum wage, that we shouldn't even think about raising value-added tax. That's just my take on it.
But the thing is like, you get... So, I mean, this is why I'm glad that I don't work in the government, right? Because what you say sounds so great. It's like, well, the people can't survive off 15%. Fine. So as a person in government, you got to look at it like, so now do I worry about the fact that the people in my country, if I increase the tax, people in my country probably ain't gonna be able to eat. But if I don't increase the tax, then at some point my people will suffer, because the value of the local dollar going down, and they're gonna be hot, and they're gonna be hard for them in the long term. So that's the honest question that you have to look at. It's like, maybe less than 50% of people would be able to survive with that 15% or higher right now if we don't increase the minimum wage. But if we keep going on the track that we going, which don't seem like a very fun ride, we're going to end up in a situation where this great bragging right we have, well, you could always change a dollar. You could always change a Bahamian dollar for one US dollar. And I know it hasn't been exactly that for a long time, but it's been close enough for us to always brag and be like, yeah, you could always just use an American dollar over here. It's fine. And you'll just get the same amount of change. Or you could just exchange the exact amount of money you have if you go into the States, and it's fine. But at some point, things will get tough for the whole country.
Yes, it's definitely a dilemma that we're in. But I was reading the newspaper recently, and there was a story that really caught my eye based on the way it was put in the media. The title of the story was "Murder Rate Rises by 61%. Police Commissioner hails over crime drop, but denies curfew played part." Okay, what caught my eye really was the end where it said, "But denies curfew played part." I don't see how those two things correlate. And it's been like such a thing that's been constantly put in the media where, and I'm not blaming any one news outlet or anything. I'm just speaking in general, where it's been like something that's a sweeping generalization nowadays, that curfew is somehow completely connected to a spike in murder rates. Do you guys agree?
I don't agree. Because I feel as though all curfew showed us was that if a murderer intends to murder, they're going to do it. It's the same way, like, if somebody planned to break into your house, they're gonna break into your house. They're gonna find the most applicable time to break into your house. Because the crime statistics dropped by, 2%? I believe the paper
said. I'm gonna give you the percentages. So they were saying 26% in crimes against persons. They were also saying it's a 61% overall, but 2% decrease in overall crime.
Yeah, so the point is crime overall decreased by 2%. So, I mean,
crime overall decreased by 2%, but murder increased by 61%, right? Yeah, but what was really hitting me was that it was January 1st to September 30th that was compared of 2021 to 2020. And it's like, how could you compare these 2 years when we were in lockdown for a majority of the year last year? So of course there's going to be an increase. I don't think it can be directly correlated to curfew unless you have some type of statistics that I don't know, but I don't think that those statistics should be compared.
They're compared because that's how it's typically done.
But that should not be done that way.
You could say that there should be an asterisk next to that statistic, and that we should recognize, it's like, this is what happened in the most recent year, 2020 to now. However, to get a proper depiction of the situation, we should look at the last time that we were free in during this time period, which is just 2019. So it's just like 2020 to 2021. Here's the comparison. This is the asterisk. But what we should be really looking at is 2019 to see how we've actually done in like mostly free versus free situations, you know? So you have a point.
There was actually another article that was put out June 25th where the state minister for national security at the time, Keith Bell, was saying that each year was a record year. We always say that every year. We say, oh, it's been a record year this year. And he was saying that the reason that we always focus on murder. We don't think about overall, like how we said, the overall it had decreased, but we were focusing more on the murder rate uptake because he said, fundamentally, the reason why the murder rate is held at such a high level is because they represent someone's family that's suffering and a community loss. And I completely understand that. But I think as a people, we should focus on crime on the whole because it gives us a bad look when we focus only on murder when there's other issues, like we had said before. We should focus on the reason why these people are being murdered and what it's related to.
Well, in the article that I read that was related to this, they actually stated the reasons for murder. They said that the most common motive for the murder is retaliation and conflict. And this motive accounted for 55% of killings this year. And that overall, the police were able to solve 59% of all murder cases that occurred in this 9-month period. And they also talked about armed robberies and robberies, sexual assault, and stuff like that.
Yeah, and the commissioner actually got upset. You could see in his response when they related it to curfew that he got really upset that they were trying to really devalue the war. Like, officers are really working hard, and and you just sat there and tried to connect it to curfew, and I don't think it's something that should be connected to each other.
Yes, I agree. I think they were probably just trying to see, okay, well, has curfew had any impact on this? And I understand where the curiosity is coming from.
Yeah, like y'all said, it's not something that kind of correlates with the curfew times. And even if it did, quantitative analysis, it's really important to kind of gather quantitative and qualitative. I think when you ask the police headquarters for information, especially when you're doing research and all of that stuff, they kind of give you the meat of everything. They give you all the data that they have. But a lot of times when they're reporting, like when the public gets the information from police to reporter to public, most of the times it's only gonna be that qualitative data, that the raw numbers. They're not gonna give you the full depth of every situation.
Thank you for tuning into Candid today, where we talked about a huge amount of topics. We went from economy to education to crime. We hope that you enjoyed the discussion that we had today. You can follow us on our social media at Candid Talks on Facebook and Instagram. Keep it real, Bahamas.